I want to call this meeting of the House Intern Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order for November 13, 2017. We'll be having a series of informational meetings this afternoon. So the first one of those is going to be an update on implementation of House Bill 2013. So I'll open an informational meeting on that and invite Gwen up to the podium. So our first couple of hearings are updates on bills that we passed to get a sense of where they're at and what they're doing. So welcome.
Hi, good afternoon, and love to see that I was first today. So hello, I just want to check to make sure that this, is this what I'll use, or should I use the...
Or the mouse.
On the mouse, okay, either one would work? Okay.
Yep.
So well, hello Chair Lively and Co-Chairs Hack and Peluso. For the record, my name is Gwen Bachtel. I am the Preschool Promise Program Coordinator at the Early Learning Division, and thank you for inviting me today to provide you with an update on the implementation progress of House Bill 2013. House Bill 2013 revised original legislation for Preschool Promise to address some of the unintended implementation challenges in the original legislation. The key concepts of House Bill 2013 that impact Preschool Promise are the Early Learning Council may establish child eligibility criteria other than income eligibility. It directs the Early Learning Council to establish rules regarding staff qualification. The previous legislation required a bachelor's degree for lead teachers. And instead of salary requirements, the Early Learning Council shall establish salary guidelines, and the Early Learning Division will provide technical assistance to provide to providers on how to incorporate the salary guidelines into their existing infrastructure systems. And the last one is the Early Learning Council will develop strategies that strive to increase the mean salary, not just of preschool teachers, but also the support staff in those classrooms. So to develop the most appropriate implementation strategies, the work group will use research, data, surveys, and statewide expertise to develop strategies that align with the Early Learning Division equity lens and promote high-quality programming. And the Early Learning Division will develop training and technical assistance to support appropriate implementation for the next program year, which is in July of 2018. So in September, Early Learning Division staff identified stakeholders and developed a timeline for implementation. An external work group began meeting in October, and one-on-one stakeholder interviews began in November. We will provide an early learning system briefing by January and have newer revised administrative rules and policies adopted by April of 2018. Then training and technical assistance will be provided to hubs and/or providers so that full implementation will occur by July of 2018. The work group consists of hub leaders and staff who are responsible for the implementation and oversight of Preschool Promise. Five meetings have been scheduled and two have already occurred. And as you can see from the slide, the hubs that are involved in this work group are Early Learning Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas. We also have Northwest Regional, Marion and Polk, Lane, Southern Oregon, and also Eastern Oregon Early Learning Hubs. And then additional stakeholder engagement. To inform the work group, individual interviews are being conducted with other stakeholder groups, including Head Start, the Children's Institute, Oregon Head Start Association, AFSCME, and others. And you can see on the in the blue on the side who we're looking to be working with individually to get more expertise and information from. Also, surveys are being used to gather more perspectives that will inform the work group. So I guess that's it. So in conclusion, we're on track to meet our implementation goals and timelines, and I thank you for the opportunity to share, and if you had any additional questions, the discussions have been very rich, but we're making significant progress.
Concerns? Questions? Excuse me. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very exciting to hear the progress. I'm assuming some of the community-based organizations would be like Latino Network and other culturally specific organizations?
Yes. You're right on track. Yeah. We have definitely some community-based organizations that are either implementers of Preschool Promise or are very connected to Preschool Promise and the cultural and linguistic diversity that we're serving.
Other questions? Comments? I guess we'll learn more as you get further into it. And so July of 2018 is implementation.
Right. What we're hoping to do is have all the training and technical assistance done before then so that any of the new rules or policies can be implemented in the next program year with the students and families starting.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Okay. So I'll close the informational hearing on the implementation of HB 2013, and now we're going to adjust our schedule a little bit and go to the informational hearing on the Office of Child Care Statutory Work Group. And Marion, thank you for being here. Open that discussion.
Great.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the Early Childhood and Family Support Committee. For the record, my name is Miriam Calderon, and I'm the Early Learning System Director. I wanted to start today by kicking off this informational update, talking about recent Early Learning Council actions on protecting young children from lead exposure in water sources and licensed child care facilities. And I have Don Woods here, our child care director, who's going to provide an update on the statutory work group. So first to talk about lead. The Early Learning Council took actions in September and October to strengthen our rules around lead exposure in water in licensed child care. These actions included requiring licensed child care facilities to test for lead in water. Looking forward to 2018, we're going to be finalizing and implementing these new rules, including the requirement to test for lead in water. We'll be working to make the results of the lead test public, available to the public. And the council has also directed the Early Learning Division to, once the results are around lead tests are available to us, to cost out the resources required for mitigation. So we are working towards having those estimates in time for 2019 and taking this next year in 2018 to actually implement testing, as well as some of the other regulatory changes that we'll be making.
Questions about that? So probably it's an unfair question. It just popped in my mind, though, when you talk about developing kind of the implementation. So I'm not familiar with historically where the state has got involved in making investments directly in the child care centers versus just doing it. So are there other examples in the past where there's issues with child care centers and it's lead paint or I don't know what it might be, where the state has taken an active role helping to finance that versus it's up to the individual child care center?
That's a great question, Jack.
Yeah, so I tried.
Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Lively, for the record, my name is Dawn Woods, and I'm the child care director, members of the committee. In the past, I don't know of any time where there has been a direct investment from the legislature. I know back when there was some testing required in well water, so water systems using a well. I believe there were some resources, but I think they were kind of done in a kind of community by community helping out. I'm not 100% sure on that, but that's my recollection.
And I think, just to add to what Don said, you know, part of this effort is looking at other states and what action states have been taking around testing in lead. So, you know, I think we're learning a range of responses that states have taken to be able to invest in mitigation, right? So, you know, buying new faucets all the way to, you know, other recommended. So those are things we have to look at, including at looking at other what other states have done.
And I applaud that. I think that's great. I just popped my mind that no one
water filters,
in the
yeah.
Thanks. Okay.
Great.
We're good to go.
So now we'll turn to the update on the statutory work group, and I will advance these slides here. So first, the Early Learning Division, as you know, is seeking stronger enforcement tools. We've got a need to respond with more with better tools to keep up with the changes in our state and federal laws regarding safety in child care. And as well, we in 2015 requested an audit to look at our child care licensing program and make recommendations on enhancements. And a number of the audit recommendations addressed areas where the Early Learning Division could have stronger enforcement authority. So that brings us to this moment in 2017, where in April the Early Learning Council directed the Early Learning Division to form a statutory working group to look at enforcement tools. We've had great leadership from Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, and on this statutory work group, as well as a number of stakeholders, including Children's First and AFSCME and Early Learning Council members, really guiding the work to look at a number of areas where we thought more enforcement authority was needed. The goal has been to work towards legislation in 2018 to give us some of these new authorities. So Dawn is here, and she's going to talk through some of those issues that would be addressed in potential legislation for 2018, and then I'll share some updates to wrap up the presentation. And I'll advance slides for you.
Okay, thank you. And I don't know, I know that Chair Lively and Representative Peluso have been really involved. I'm not sure if you want to have anything to add before I go into the recommendations, or do you want me just to dive in?
I would just say that I commend, it's been great to be involved in this process, and all the stakeholders on the committee have done a great job. We've had very robust conversations to understand a lot the implications and things, and so from my standpoint, having served on a lot of different work groups, this is the one of those from my standpoint. I felt all of us on the work group when we came out had a much better understanding, and the consensus was across the board on kind of the actions to take. So for me, it's been a great process, and I appreciate the work all of you have done to get it there. It's been a good group to work on.
Great, thank you. So six of the statutory changes that have been identified through the work group is, and I'll kind of just do an overview and then I'll go more deeply into what does that really mean, is to allow the Office of Child Care to take action when a license expires, to better protect children from providers who have had significant licensing violations in the past, to give us the authority to grant cease and desist orders and levy different civil penalties, looking to increase the civil penalties in statute, and looking at to more explicitly allow us to impose conditions on facility licenses and also individuals' central background registry. And then also looking at how we can better foster information sharing and collaboration between Office of Child Care and DHS, the child welfare staff. And so to kind of get into what those look like, the first one is in continuing jurisdiction. So currently, if a license expires before a legal action is completed, we lose that jurisdiction and that legal action doesn't reach finality. And so this would allow us to complete a legal action even once a license maybe has expired. And that'll allow us to have those final orders in line so that if someone, say, reapplies for a license, it's very clear that there's been an action taken on that person and that there's a reason to be concerned. The next one is around exempt provider prohibition. And there's currently a loophole in the way that this statute is written in terms of if you have had a significant licensing violation and we suspend or revoke your license, there's a loophole that will allow another individual to come into that same facility and remain to provide care there. And so this would shorten it up so that those that have been identified as having licensing violations and not able to care for children to prohibit that care within that facility. And so it will strengthen, simplify, and really clarify the existing statute so that we can better protect children based on particularly a provider's history of noncompliance. The next one is a cease and desist order. And so currently we do not have the authority to issue cease and desist orders. And the only way that we can take an action, and this is really, we see this a lot in unlicensed childcare programs, is to go through an injunction process. And that is a very long, drug-out process. It's the court, it's costly, there's a lot of time involved. And so to be able to issue a cease and desist will allow us to more actively issue that order on individuals who are continuing to care for more than three children and not be licensed. I can share, I mean, there are examples where maybe we've had an individual caring for 29 children, and our current penalties civil penalties have not been enough to deter that. And so this would allow us to really ensure that the children are safe within those and have some level of oversight.
Can I ask a question about that one before you go on?
Yeah.
I'm sure this is really a hard one, because where do those 29 kids go? Do you have any thoughts about if you were to issue a cease and desist, what the implication would be for the families that have kids? Do you have any thoughts about backup plans for that?
Yeah, I think how we've been thinking about it is we would treat it and provide the resources to the families just like we do when we need to suspend or revoke a license. And so we would connect them with 211 information. We would be able to, the licensing specialists would be going out there to gather those records and try to help them find the resources that they need. The next one is a civil penalty. Currently, our civil penalties are very low. It could be from a $50 to, you know, about a $100 civil penalty. And that, you know, given, I don't think these have been raised really since 1972 when our statutes were first established. And there's been significant inflation in our economy over those time. And they really are not serving as a deterrent, as a real consequence to having violations. And so what this statute is looking to do is to increase the penalty structure and have it capped within statute so that, that we would be able to kind of adjust those within rule, but that there would be an established cap within the statute. And the next one is placing conditions on a license. So currently there is some It's mentioned in our statute, the ability to issue a condition on a license. It's not very explicit, and so really looking at making sure that it's very clear that we can issue a condition, and kind of an example of why conditions are important for us to keep kids safe. Is like, for instance, within a family child care home, you may have the way your house is situated. You could be in your house, you know, like right at the screen, sliding glass door, and have kids outside because you're able to see them and hear them. If you have a yard that is has like an L shaped on it, we may say, no, you have to be out in the yard. So depending on the environment, we often may need to put a condition on a license in order to make sure that kids are safe. We also see that a lot if there's certain areas of a home that aren't, you know, really at a level that would be safe for kids to be in, we would put on a condition to say childcare children may not be in the garage. You know, an example like that. So we really just want to make that explicitly clear so that there's no questions on our ability to issue a condition. The other statutory change that we're looking for is to have a tiered progressive enforcement structure. So currently, we have, you know, we have the ability to issue an emergency suspension. You know, if it reaches a certain threshold, we have the ability to revoke a license, suspend a license. But where we, it's hard to look at the history of noncompliances within a facility, and so this progressive enforcement would may kind of act like it would on your driver's license. So you would get so many points in which then certain actions would come into play in terms of enforcement. And, you know, we're hoping we see this both as transparency for the provider in terms of what the expectations are, as well as consistency for us as an agency in terms of how we issue those enforcement actions. So there really is a clear picture, as well as for families to understand what the different violations are, what this program has looked at and for, and I think providing that greater transparency. And then the next...
Thanks. So I wanted to talk a little bit about our collaboration with DHS. Last Monday at the statutory work group meeting, I asked Deputy Director Richardson from DHS to join me and talk about the areas in which we're looking at how we work better together to keep children safe in licensed childcare. So as you may know, the Office of Child Care does not conduct investigations in cases of abuse and neglect in the ways that some folks might think, you know, interviewing children or teachers or, you know, gathering that kind of evidence that informs instead our actions. Instead, we really rely on our partnering agencies, including CPS, to conduct those investigations, and we use the evidence and the conclusions from those investigations to inform our actions around a licensed facility. We are really excited by conversations that we're having about ways in which we could enhance the way we work together so that the Office of Child Care could get firsthand information as well as, you know, more robust information that will help us ultimately be successful in the case instances where we need to keep children safe in a particular facility. So some of the areas that we're looking at in terms of our work together is conducting joint investigations. So again, the practice right now is, you know, often that Office of Child Care staff are sort of hang back while investigations unfold, and so if we were to have a team of staff that were trained in being able to do investigations, we think our work to build cases where we need to would be enhanced if we could sort of go out together. The other area that we're looking at is information sharing. So we are constantly in the course of an investigation, sharing a lot of information we might have about a particular individual or a facility in terms of their compliance, as well as CPS staff doing investigations are also gathering a lot of information that's really, as I mentioned before, essential for us to be able to take action. And so we're looking at in some areas where we would be codifying some of these practices or really through an intergovernmental agreement, or actually looking at if there are any statutory barriers, really being able to bring those forward to the committee and ultimately include in legislation so we can have any barriers that do exist in terms of our sharing our records and information with each other, have those removed. And then finally, the other area that we're looking at is just on issuing findings and how CPS issues findings in these investigations involving licensed child care facilities. And one idea that has emerged here is in some instances, while the investigation may not be able to conclude who was ultimately responsible for the harm to the child, the investigation could conclude where the harm occurred, if the harm occurred in a licensed child care facility. We feel like the work of CPS to make that determination official as part of their process would help us on the action side in terms of licensing. So we're calling that, you know, really issuing a finding on a child care facility on where the harm occurred, if the who was responsible for the harm to a child wasn't able to be established. So we, again, are the majority of these steps that we'll take to enhance our collaboration will be done through an intergovernmental agreement that we'll be working on in short order, but did want to flag that for this committee in the event that there are some barriers that need to be addressed around information sharing that we would hope to include in potential legislation for the committee.
So before we move on, does anybody have any questions about this kind of, this is extremely important when you talk about child safety. And again, I want to say, working with the group, I think they've done a very thorough job and identified a lot of areas where we need to make changes and improvements, but it is critically important. So Representative Hayden, if you have.
Hey, Chair Lively, I had one question on the, going back to the civil penalty caps in statute. Have you determined what that cap dollar figure would be? I mean, what kind of magnitude increase are we looking at?
Yeah, let me.
I want to say, I was just going to double
check.
Answer
is yes.
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden. Yeah, it actually kind of, based on the size of the facility, the caps are identified. And so currently in some proposed language is that for a registered family, the cap would be $750. For a certified family, which are the large family child care homes, would be $1,200. And for a certified center, it would be up to $2,500.
Is that per incident or per violation? Because I'm assuming there could be multiple violations on a given date.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It would be per violation. And again, what the thinking is that while these would be capped, it would be further defined potentially at a lower amount in rule.
So significant.
Significant.
That's right.
And that's compared to what are they now?
They can be, like, I think the highest is $150.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was quite a bit of conversation about that. In fact, following conversation, we agreed the recommendations would be even higher than where we started off. It goes kind of back to, so what level do you have to reach that it really is effective from trying to change the behavior versus not? And there is always going to be the issue about that cost. The impact it has on the facility, but remember, this is about child safety, and they won't get to those levels if there wasn't something that had been demonstrated from the staff and within our rules that there needed to be some pretty strong statement made about those. So, but it is a cap, so within the rules there will be a range which, depending on the violation or what the concern is, what that might end up. But the goal is to get to be a really disincentive from people doing things. In the past, $150 may not have been any kind of incentive.
Just follow
up. Sure, go ahead.
And that would be applied to licensed and non-licensed equally?
No.
So this is just for non-licensed.
This is just
licensed.
For licensed.
Just for
licensed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the non-licensed wouldn't have a civil penalty?
They would. There's actually can be a civil penalty, and I think we have that at potentially $1,500. Could be capped at the fine. A lot of the way that we've been kind of thinking about the implementation is it also connects to that tiered, that progressive enforcement. So as you're having civil penalties, we may tier them to be that deterrent. Our current practice is we don't issue a civil penalty on the first violation. We provide technical assistance and make sure that they understand the rules, unless it's something, you know, very serious and, you know, a high risk with imminent danger to a child.
One more.
Sure, no good.
And would it be possible to offer a carrot for those facilities where you come in and they get no violations? They get like $1,000 reward or something from those fines.
Cool.
You know, something to encourage them to have a clean inspection each time.
So, Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, actually, we are. It's not quite a carrot in terms of dollars, which I'm sure they would appreciate as well. But we are looking at implementing. It's called risk assess rules, which is also part of that progressive, and differential monitoring. So if you do have a clean record and you've showed a history of noncompliance, we can do a shortened checklist, which is a way for we're going in, we're looking at all the rules, but it's a much shortened fashion. So they've just always are in compliance, so they're going to have us in their business a little less time.
Okay. Well, I always like reward, you know.
Yeah.
Positive reinforcement.
It's a budget thing, Representative.
Yeah.
But I agree with you.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Lively. I want to build on what my colleague is saying. This is reminding me a lot of the conversation that we had both in foster care, behavioral rehabilitation services, as well as long-term care in facilities. Mm-hmm. We've had these kind of conversations about accountability on one end because of some very unfortunate news stories that have come out. And so I support the accountability. I support your flexibility. I do think that, number one, the rulemaking is really important because you might be a fabulous administrator, but you don't know if there's an administrator that comes along and is very heavy-handed in it. And we all know the context of because of regulation of child care from the feds, we've had the number of child care providers drop. So I am very concerned about that, as I am in other settings. The other thing about the long-term care is that fee structure, that fine structure, goes into a quality fund to both do the prevention side, which I always think is as important, at least, as the accountability side. Mm-hmm. What is it you can do to really provide training and other kind of support so that people don't get into this situation where they end up getting fined. And so the more you can use those fines into a quality fund that goes back and might be used as a reward, which in fact it is in long-term care facilities. It goes into training that benefits the whole sector, but it also goes into incentive programs. So I really want to support that effort. I do want to say I'm really impressed with what the group came up with, and I'm sorry that I wasn't able to be at any of the meetings, even though I was a part of it. But I am very impressed with the work that the work group did.
Others? So, Representative Kengar, the question you raised earlier about the number of child care. So, you know, the trade-off, first, there is no trade-off when it comes to child safety, so we have to do that. But the unfortunate outcome of some of that is indeed some child care facilities will be closed, which leaves parents in a lurch in some cases, especially depending on where they live, what their options might be. And we've talked earlier, we had a task force bill around ERDC and other things last time that didn't get funded. But others have approached me about this whole having a strategy from a state standpoint of how we get more affordable quality child care. So what I'm thinking is after the short session that we can maybe have a work group that works on it before we get cleared up in 2019. Yeah. It talks, because again, with the CRDC, it's a lot of different things, but we know. And every one of these, unfortunately, that ends up being closed because of these issues is another group of children and their families that are faced with this same dilemma. So I think that's something we need to continue to look at.
Well, if I can add something, Mr. Sure. Chair, you might even consider in using these fines in a quality fund or something, it might also be a mitigation fund. You might actually pay families who then have to miss work because they're spending the next 2 or 3 days looking for child care. So I think there's some really innovative ways that you can use those fines to mitigate the harm done to families as well as incentivize good behavior as well as provide prevention for the entire field. I hope that you don't have that much money to have to do that.
Yeah,
we should look for other sources for that to complement that.
What do they do with the fines now?
Anything else?
Good question.
Is it?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Just follow up again, that brought up follow up, and that was kind of the point I was getting to. Is this money put aside, or does it just go into the general budget? I mean, what happens to the fines?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, you know, I'll be honest. I think it's gone just into the general operating costs. We don't have a lot of state investment. Most of our dollars go to ERDC, and so it just hasn't been a lot of money. And I mean, in fact, it actually costs us more to get the civil penalties and staff time and process than we earn. So that's another kind of part of wanting to increase them. But I think it's a really great idea to think about how to reinvest that. And I also neglected to say that part of the incentive as well is not just on the in differential monitoring, but also SPARC and the quality improvement process and the funds that are going to be needed to help programs attain their quality, as well as the bonuses that they're able to receive by having good compliance history and meeting those quality standards in terms of having a bonus within their ERDC payment.
Okay. Marion?
Great, sorry. Thanks. So I did also want to mention other strategies that we have put into place around the issue of child safety. One is that we have increased the number of unannounced visits. So currently, every licensed facility in the state of Oregon gets one announced visit and one unannounced visit. And then when there are complaints or concerns, there are additional unannounced visits. We're currently looking at facilities, again, where there's a pattern of concerns or compliance issues, and looking within the resources and the current capacity that we have, increasing the number of unannounced visits. We are also implementing new requirements for certification in the Central Background Registry. So it is going to, I think, be more initially harder to get in and get approved and certified within the CBR, as well as stay certified. So some of these are new requirements. Some of the changes are also new federal requirements in terms of checks in the FBI database, multi-state sex offender registries going back 5 years, as well as implementation of a federal requirement where anybody with a history of a violent, certain violent crimes would be permanently disqualified from being certified in the Central Background Registry. We are also looking at upgrades to provide more transparency for parents as they're making decisions around child care. So we have both, again, a new early learning information system that we'll be implementing that we'll be launching later this year that's going to help us be able to help parents do all of their kind of searching around the full compliance history and looking at all of the monitoring, getting all of the information from all of our monitoring visits online. So right now, only some information is available when you search online around our monitoring visits, and families have to pick up a phone and actually call the office and speak with somebody on our team to be able to get the full monitoring history. So that's a change we're really excited about, as well as some new leadership and other changes that we've made in our practices. We are feeling really, I think, encouraged by what the data is showing us around all of these actions and the way that we're working to enhance the safety of children in licensed child care. Data showing that between 2016 and 2017, we've seen sort of a near doubling of our legal actions around concerns and safety concerns in child care. So that's all very encouraging. And as we look forward to next steps, we are hopeful that the committee will approve the action to work on legislation for the 2018 session, and we stand ready to work with the committee and provide any technical assistance that we can around this legislation. So with that, I will conclude and ask if there are any further questions.
Any further questions?
Chair, is this a
Representative Malmstrom? Excuse me.
Committee bill?
Yeah, that's what the intent. Representative Malmstrom?
As far as the thank you, Chair Levy. The frequency of the visits, is that different for when you were a new, you know, site versus or a site that maybe has had problems in the more recent past? Or is there just a blanket, everybody gets so many visits? How does that, what is that schedule like?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Chair Lively, Representative Malmstrom. So there's currently a minimum requirement set, and that is everybody has one announced and everybody has one unannounced visit. I would say part of the work of the progressive enforcement actions that we're looking at is we also go out with any complaint. We're going to go out and do an assessment on any complaint that comes in, and that would be an unannounced visit. So, you know, that's going to depend on the number of complaints a facility gets. As well as one of the strategies that we've been employing is when there is a facility of concern, we will increase monitoring visits. And so that, you know, it'll, you know, it depends on the, you know, if we need to go out every 2 weeks, every month for a while, until we're sure that any concerns have been addressed.
Chair Lively, Rep. Malmstrom, I'll just add to that and say, you know, that is a just a very kind of blanket, as Dawn said, that's sort of the minimum. There is a lot of differentiation that certainly happens, both on because of complaints or, you know, licensing specialists that want to provide technical assistance. And through these visits, you know, we'll certainly do more any time we can. I just wanted to be, you know, really honest and upfront about what the resource constraints are, though. I mean, this is something that is literally a caseload issue. And right now in Oregon, the caseloads are triple the industry standard for licensing specialists to facility. So we will continue to always do as much as we can with the resources that we have, but certainly if there were more staff, we could get into places more and provide more support, as well as more monitoring.
Can you follow me?
Sure, go ahead.
Just to follow up on that, is there a way that, you know, and I haven't seen these, you know, visits in action, but perhaps instead of making it feel so much like a stick and maybe a little more like a carrot, when these visits happen, are they also seen by the facilities as a learning experience, how they can make it better, not just not screw up, but, you know, that kind of thing?
Right. Chair Lively, Rep. Malmstrom, I know Dawn's got a perspective here, but I just wanted to share that I've been able to go out now on with two licensing specialists in two different field offices, both on an unannounced visit, on a visit to a regulated subsidy provider, and, you know, it is very much, I think, really that experience where there's a lot of information and recommendations that are made really right there on site, on the spot, and a number of our providers are often very isolated in terms of, you know, being able to talk with other professionals about their practice or about safety issues or about our regulations. And so, you know, I think some of these visits are very important. So it is very much, you know, the balance of being able to come in and look at and assess the situation for safety issues, but as well being that resource for that provider and being able to share information. And one of the regulated subsidy visits, I came back and said to Dawn, you know, some of these new visits that we're doing with these providers could actually help provide information about how to become licensed to be able to serve more children. When the one visit that I was on, you know, that provider was very interested in potentially being a registered family. So there's lots of opportunities, I think, in these visits.
And Chair Lively, Representative Malmstrom, if I could kind of add on to that, is I actually really appreciate that question because we definitely came here with enforcement strategy, so it sounded very, you know, dropping the hammer, so to speak. But I would say that in general, you know, our licensors have really strong relationships with the providers, and we want to be there to help support them. The supply, it's a very hard job, so we want to do our best to support them. Really, these monitoring and these enforcements are really when we have a provider who's really struggling to maintain those foundational health and safety standards to allow us more action, which is, you know, a small percentage of child care programs. But that all in all, we want to help them be successful.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Lively. You mentioned that starting in January 2017 or the beginning of this year that there was fingerprint background checks, and according to the website here, Oregon's website, that has to go into every state that the person resided in the last 5 years for several of the things, the criminal justice system, sex offender, child abuse, child neglect. And then it talks about the National Sex Offender Registry, that they would look at that. My question is that updated once a year, or is that updated once every 5 years?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden. So the national search is done in terms of the sex offender registry, the child abuse and neglect. Those are done every 5 years within our state. However, the running, we do a quarterly LEDS check on everybody in our registry. So we have just under 60,000 individuals in our central background registry. So we do the quarterly, we're checking to ensure that there has been no crimes committed in Oregon while that person is enrolled in the registry.
So you do those internally, and these other checks are done by the facility?
No, these other checks are done by us during an initial, when they initially apply in the central background registry. And so that will be complete. Every 5 years, we'll do that other state check.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But we do an in-state check quarterly.
How about if they live on the border?
That's a good question.
Are you satisfied?
Yeah, I mean, 5 years seems like a long time, but it sounds like in the state of Oregon,
right.
Assuming most reside here, and of course you got Vancouver and Portland where somebody could easily live across, that you check in-state and then out-of-state you check every 5 years.
Yeah.
5 years seems like a long time to me.
It seems like a long time.
Any other questions? So the intention will be this will be a committee bill. So we'll get it submitted, and then obviously we'll have hearings and discussions during the short session, but that's been our intent all along as they were working on this, to be able to have something introduced for this short session. So. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I'll close the informational hearing on the Office of Child Care Statutory Work Group. And now we'll go back to and open an informational hearing on the Court Care Pilot Program in Marion and Polk Counties. Well, this is another bill. This is Representative Peluso.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
How's everybody doing?
I think they're doing all right. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm still Brent DeMo, and I still work out in Polk County. I'm the director of the Family and Community Outreach Department. And to my right?
My name is Erin Dawson. I'm the secretary for the Board of Directors for Court Care here in Marion County.
Very good.
Thank you for asking us to come back. Are you guys as excited as we are that Court Care is finally open in Marion and Polk County, right?
Yay.
It's always crazy because nobody ever claps in here, but like this is normally where we would do that, right? I sent Lisa a handout. I brought paper ones. I forgot about the electronic rule. It has some updates. Do they have that in front of them?
It's posted in OLIS. We don't have it necessarily. Some of us don't have our computers.
Well, I can make things up then. This will be great.
Okay. We'll check you later when we go to OLIS.
I left some back there if you do want to grab them if they don't come into your inbox. But we're going to be brief and just let you know. The most exciting thing is we opened both facilities September 5th, both in Marion and Polk County. In Marion County, the YMCA offers the licensed child care program, and in Polk County, it is Family Building Blocks. So we've been open just over 60 days, and during that time, we have already served 86 individual kids.
Wow, really?
And on the handout that you don't have in front of you, but it does say the majority of them are coming for court-related reasons, both court and mediation. That's about 73 of those kids there. But people are also using it for respite care, drug and alcohol classes, mental health services, medical appointments, and housing appointments, dropping their kids off so then they can meet with those other professionals. Other things we wanted to tell you in the form of an update, we are forming a regional steering committee. We took the big coalition that had too many people to form an effective committee down to a two-county committee where we will be meeting regularly to make sure that we're doing the updates you guys want, collecting all of that data, demographic information, tracking our referrals, talking to the judicial system and the early learning system to look for ways to improve so we can come back and give you your reports and your data for the future as well. Erin's going to talk a little bit about our shared marketing.
Yes. In addition to what Brent mentioned, we're also going to be seeking some, we're going to be pursuing grant writing with our shared committee as well. Other fundraising efforts, events that we can promote to both communities. Our marketing, generally speaking, so far has been outbound in the form of marketing our services. So the 86 is a wonderful start, but we're very optimistic that it will ultimately become much higher. One of the ways that we're doing that is the courthouse on the Marion County side, and I believe on the Polk County side, is engaging in a really robust dialogue with a number of individuals both within their offices, so the judges, the judicial assistants, admin at the court, and kind of within the courthouse, as well as they're reaching out to other community members. DHS so far has been one of our biggest referral sources. Based on the numbers that you see, well, you don't see here, but you will see soon, the DHS is referring their clients for their court proceedings. But the text of the bill does allow for folks to use the services that Court Care provides, not only for court appointments and meetings. So they might meet with their attorney in the courthouse. They might come for mediation or a parenting class that's required in order to proceed through, say, a family law dispute. But they may also meet with their DHS caseworker as long as that office is within what's considered kind of a near proximity to a courthouse complex. So Marion County being a much bigger county, we wanted to very mindfully kind of jumpstart the program where we were focusing the majority of our outreach marketing on those people we knew would use the service the most in kind of the most time-sensitive manner. So victims' assistance, people who are seeking restraining orders, things like that. But now that we see the numbers coming in, we want to expand our marketing services to include, say, the municipal court or other programs within the same kind of courthouse complex feel. We're going to expand it to include jurors on the Marion County side, which I believe Polk County is already doing. So we wanted to start it in a way that was sustainable so that we weren't overwhelming our service providers, but that we were targeting it to the people who would ultimately need it the most. And now that we see that their needs are being met, we're going to include others within the community who could also use it.
I also, many of you have known me for a long time in my career, and you know I used to work at the Early Learning Division back when it was the Child Care Division. I wanted to dovetail on something that Dawn said, just so you see, there's nothing worse than when you guys pass a bill or start a program and it works in a silo, right? That's just awful. I want to let you know how closely we do work with programs. Some of the things you said about quality and some of the things that you said about, is that licensing visit just somebody coming out and looking to slap on the hand? So one, I want to tell you that our program in Polk County is actually 5-star rated in Oregon's QRIS program, now called SPARK. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? Well, you have to work really closely with your local child care resource and referral program. They have staff that help you on that quality side to be a better center. And then how do you get creative with your licensing specialist? And we have an excellent licensing specialist who helped us look at what we needed to do to make this facility the highest quality. So we don't work in a silo. We're actually working together with the staff at the Early Learning Division, of course, our local Early Learning Hub, and others to do all of this together and not separate. So I thought that was worth mentioning, just so you guys know that part. Also, Chair Lively, you talked about rewards. So we don't give out cash or anything, but all the kids in both programs do get to leave with a book every time. So that's at least something, right?
That's great. It is.
And we wanted to talk just briefly about some next steps. Aaron mentioned that the Marion County program that they're looking at changing a little bit to allow jurors to come. That's new in the last couple of months. And one of the things I wanted to say in Polk County is the service has been deemed so valuable that the county has stepped forward to look at funding another day, Fridays, because out in Polk County, we actually have a mental health court. And a lot of the participants bring their kids to mental health court. So if we are able to open all days on Fridays, which our goal is January 1, we will do that. We will be able to provide not only another 9 hours of service, but specifically target the mental health court clients, and they can drop their kids off as well. And Aaron, I think you were going to say something there.
Oh, it was just to dovetail off of something you said. One of the things we're trained to be very mindful of is that this is a pilot program and that the purpose was to look at an urban area as well as a rural area. So in rolling the services out kind of in different manners on each side of the river, we're able to really keep track of what is working, what is reaching the community that needs it the most, so that later when we have conversations about other communities in Oregon, we can share with them what was the most efficient use of our resources, who you needed to reach out to, and as Brent talked about, maybe combining both the legal community and the early learning community so that we can reach the largest population possible in the most efficient manner.
We also want to let you know that we haven't forgotten our promise at looking at other funding mechanisms so the legislature doesn't have to look at funding this forever. So we are working on researching how those other states are doing this. And we actually, Representative Pluso, we do want to come and talk to you. I understand you might be on another committee, too, with Justice. Mm-hmm. We want to talk about potentially another bill to look at doing this faster than 2 years. So we've already had at least 4 other counties contact us asking us how they can do this. So we have some ideas, so it's not taking money away from the general fund, but as we mentioned last year when we came to you, adding a little bit of extra to certain fees that people pay currently, for example, a DUI or something like that, add $2 to that and it'll go to fund court care in a new county next year. So we want to come and talk about possibly a bill now. I understand the deadline is close.
Yep.
Next week.
Tomorrow.
Okay. I'll find you. So you've heard from what we said, but we're obviously slightly biased. We advocate for this program. I just want to read 2 quick quotes of what parents are saying who use the program. So the first one is from a single father. Being able to have a loving place for my children during court is a huge stress off of me as a single father. And the next one, I am so grateful for your services. It is making it possible for me to be on time to court and gives her, my daughter, the chance to get in the routine of being around other people and kids in a safe environment. Last thing we want to say, come and visit us. Let us know if you want to visit. I know proximity to the program in Marion, it's much closer. It's a few blocks from here. Polk County's only 14 minutes away, y'all. Come check us out, too. But if you want to come see us in action, you can get a hold of myself or Aaron, and we'd be happy to set that up. And we're also happy to take any questions you might have.
Can I just say this is, being involved with the legislature for some time, this is enormously exciting, both from the aspect of how quickly you've been able to implement. Secondly, the number of people. I didn't have a concept in my mind how many children or people will be involved and your willingness to look at how this does. To me, that's all. I mean, this is all very good stuff. And I compliment you again for having worked to introduce the legislation because we don't get a lot of victories quickly in some cases, but this is one of those. And good for you.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Yeah, Representative.
Well, ditto to everything you just said. Fantastic presentation and program. I'm just curious, is the mental health court only on Fridays, only operates on Fridays?
Chair Lively, Representative Kenny Geyer. In Polk County, it is only in Fridays. Mm-hmm. You know that we're a much smaller county than Marion County. We only have about 78,000 people total in our county. So right now, Fridays is mental health court. We have other unique programs, drug court and a few others that meet on different days. Mm-hmm. We're going to be looking at providing services for all of them if space, staff, and time allows.
Thank you, Chair Lively. You mentioned that 86 children have taken advantage of it. I think 73 through court and 13 through miscellaneous. Just curious, what's the average length of stay for those children? Is it different between court, those individual lives? Because a court case can go on for weeks. I mean, is that 86 days or 86 hours or what?
Right, Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, you're kind of hitting the nail on the head. It is different for every case. I mean, imagine if you're just going maybe to do something with traffic court, it's pretty short. But if it is something more like a trial or there's pre-trial or you're on the docket but you don't know exactly what time, we have had kids that have come for multiple days, the entire week that we're open in both sites, they would stay the entire time as long as we had it available. Unfortunately, we're not open 5 days a week in either site right now. That's a dream for the future. But if we were open 5 days a week, we really see people who have to be there the whole time, especially if you get called for jury duty and you don't regularly have child care and now you suddenly need it and you're going to be a juror for 3 weeks. We want to be able to have that care available so that juror can serve their duty as well. Did that answer that? It really does change depending on the type of case. It's hard to do averages right now, only being open for just over 2 months. If you made me say it, I would say the average day is 3 hours.
Okay. And how many days a week are you open?
In the Polk County program, we are open Tuesday and Thursday from 1 to 5:30 and all day Wednesday. And then we're going to be adding Fridays in January. The Marion County program is open Monday through Thursday from 8 to 5:15. And they're still debating on that Friday part and how to raise some extra money to see if Fridays are a possibility in the future as well.
And follow up.
Sure.
And then does the court, is that just when the court's open or is that, does the court work with those parents to get their hearing or whatever it is on those days? Is that coordinated or is it kind of if they get lucky?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, right now it's a little bit of luck, but the goal is to plan any hearing or any proceeding that has kids on the days that court care is available. If you're familiar with the court system at all, a lot of these things, since we opened in September, those court dates were probably planned back in February or March. So there's going to be a time of catch-up. But I can tell you, speaking firsthand with the judges in Polk County, they can't wait to look at what kind of case is coming and plan it on a day that there's court care. That's just going to take time.
Okay. And to add on that, sorry, Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, Marion County, I think one of the keys is to provide information for parents so that they can speak up when they're given a court date and indicate that they need to use the service. Because mm-hmm. I know, to echo what Brent said, that the judges are extremely excited about this. And much of the time, they may not know a child's involved. So if it's not a family law case or something else, they may not be alerted to that. So once parents start to understand, and we're going to put up some big, beautiful color posters of children having a wonderful time in court care in the lobby of the courthouses. And so it will alert the public as they come in without their children and tell that they need to talk with court staff or a judge if they need that service in order to coordinate some of their hearing times.
Okay. Yes, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Lively. My question is I don't quite know how courts work, thankfully, but when you get like a summons or you get your date, is the information provided on there that child care is provided in some way, shape, or form so that you know?
Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, that's an interesting question. If you are the victim of a crime, you actually have the luxury of having a victim advocate that works with you through the district attorney's office. So let's say that you're an unfortunate victim of a crime and you have a date coming up for a court case. Someone's going to be on the phone to you, and those people, DHS is our number one referral. The victim advocate's office is number two. If you're on the defendant side, though, it's up to your attorney to share that with you. So we give that information to the bar associations, all of the attorneys who represent defendants, everyone we could think of in the last 2 months, we're getting this information out. But there are people who are self-represented, they don't have an attorney. So they can come, like Aaron said, when they come to the courthouse, there could be a brochure. she mentioned these big, colorful, almost life-size pictures of people who are using court care so people know that it's available. We've had a couple of good articles in the newspaper, but it's just going to take time for people to know that the service is available in both of the counties.
And to tack onto that, Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, on the Marion County side, there are flyers that are going out to all pro se filers. So the judicial assistants and the folks who are actually entering those cases into the system, they send out a number of resource flyers to those folks because they understand they're at a disadvantage as far as obtaining information about the court system, and these flyers are being included.
Perhaps what you're doing, though, is giving us a really good idea. Could we convince whoever does that mailing in the courts, they're mailing it to the defendant and to the victim, can we convince them to insert something into that and have it just be routine? And I'd be happy to look at that and follow up with y'all.
Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I have a short question. What about language needs? How do you meet those?
Chair Lively, Representative Malmstrom. Great question. Right now, I'm not sure if the program has bilingual staff in both of the counties. And I'm actually, do you know, Aaron, if it's in Marion, if you have Spanish-speaking staff?
When you say staff, do you mean at site or just to get the resources
or just
staff?
To get the information out?
I can tell you right now we don't. But the Oregon Judicial Department, does have court language access services, and what they aim to do is provide interpretive services for people who have second language, a language other than English needs. And so we can connect with them because this is a service that's directly benefiting the Judicial Department and see if they would be willing to offer us translation services. If what you're asking about is primarily to give them information about the service itself, I think finding someone who can offer the service on site who has second language ability might be a little bit more challenging.
And I just turned and looked at our Family Building Blocks site director, and they do have bilingual staff, not always in the classroom, but always available if that is needed.
Anything else? Well, Representative Peluso.
Well, thank you, Chair Lively. So, again, just hearty thanks for the work of both of you in making this happen. Part of the dream when we first talked is to have this court care throughout the entire state. And we're going to continue to have that conversation and see how we can make that happen as well. And as quickly as this happened, I'm sure we can make it happen quickly again. You guys have done great work, and it's just been a terrific, terrific experience. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So I'll close the informational hearing on court care pilot program and open an informational hearing on child savings accounts. And we have Janet Bird from the Neighborhood Partnership, Ashley Oakley, Native American Youth and Family Center, and David Bell from the Treasurer's Office here to speak to us today. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. My name is Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and we really appreciate you taking time today for an update on children's savings. You might recall that we presented to you last April around a proposal that would launch what we were calling the Oregon Bright Futures Plan, something that Representative Bynum was a co-sponsor of. And the idea is to create a platform for children's savings in the state of Oregon that would give every child a stake in their future and a sense that they could grow up and do something exciting after high school. We do not have a legislative proposal to present to you today. What we're looking at doing in the interim between now and the 2019 session is launching some privately funded pilot accounts, and we're working closely with the Treasurer's Office and the Oregon College Savings Plan to do that. So we'll give you a little bit of sense of kind of where we're going with that and hope to come back to you in 2019 with a legislative proposal. So I'm going to start with just why children's savings accounts and remind you why we think they're so exciting. We know that Oregon faces a couple of really significant problems. One is our dismal high school graduation rates, which we see in communities across the state. The second is kind of a pervasive problem all across the United States, which is that people grow up kind of alienated from our financial services system, unsure how to navigate, and people obviously grow up not saving and investing for the future. And so we're looking at strategies that are going to get people habituated to save, habituated to engage with the financial industry, banks, credit unions, et cetera, and create those on-ramps for people saving for their future, similar to some of the things that have been launched recently, like Oregon Saves, the retirement savings program. We're looking at creating a culture of saving across the state. We know that children's savings accounts can do both of those things. We know not only do children having an account set up in their name, it's good for mothers, it's good for children, increases reading scores, increases math scores. We know that children with less than $500 in a savings account set aside for their post-high school pursuit are 3 times more likely to attend college and 4 times more likely to graduate from college. Since we presented to you last April, you may or may not recall that we had a researcher on the phone with you and who shared slides. She had just completed a national study of children's savings accounts, looking at both the impact of children's savings, but also looking at what are the design elements that we need to include to make sure that we reach the kids who are least likely to have children's savings. So how are we reaching communities of color, the kids who are not otherwise going to grow up thinking that they have an opportunity to do something exciting after high school? Since Rebecca Loya of Brandeis presented to you last April, there have been a couple additional studies that have been done and released that just continue to reinforce both the impact of children's savings and also that we're really on the right track in thinking about how we want to design. So the things that we're really looking closely at in terms of the design, and again, working to create a program that works in parallel with what's already going on at the Treasurer's Office and complements that and builds upon that. We know that children's savings accounts should be universal. We want this to be something that every kid in every classroom, every Head Start program, every after-school program has an Oregon Bright Futures account set aside for them. So we want it something to reach every kid. We want it to start at birth so that we have the maximum number of years for the impact to be felt. The other thing, and this is the hard nut to crack and the thing that we're going to be really looking at within the pilot design, is how do we create something that's automatic and an opt-out enrollment? We know from looking across at what's been done around the country, and there are 4 statewide children's savings account programs now and dozens of citywide or local jurisdiction programs. The Maine program is an example. For a number of years, there's been a foundation in Maine that has set aside $500 for every child born in the state at birth. They used to do a program where they would put their $500 in only if parents would also take some sort of an action and enroll their children. They switched to an automatic enrollment. And what they found was before the automatic opt-out enrollment, they were reaching 40% of children. They were reaching children who were disproportionately white, disproportionately affluent, and whose parents already were using investment vehicles. So in other words, the kids who were probably going to have some money set aside for them to do something with college or post-high school in any event. What they found after the auto-enroll opt-out setup is that they're now reaching 100% of kids. So they're reaching every kid born in the state of Maine. Pretty compelling difference, and again, really reinforces for us what we need to think about. So other, just quickly, other things that we're really looking at, we want to create something that has a small initial seed deposit so that we are universal, but we also are committed to figuring out how we can build in targeted incentives so that we're really reaching the communities that, again, most need kids to grow up thinking that they have opportunity after high school. So communities of color, rural communities where high school graduation rates are low. I mean, not all rural communities, but those which have low high school graduation rates, and other places where kids are growing up not aware of those opportunities. And then the other thing that we're really going to be working on in this pilot phase particularly is thinking about that family engagement. How are we creating that habit of savings and that culture of savings? Some of the research shows us that what we need to do is think about multiple on-ramps for people to participate. Think about ways that people can make cash deposits and in-person deposits using trusted local financial institutions, so banks and credit unions that people are familiar with and that they see in their communities. So we're, again, really committed to thinking about and experimenting with what those opportunities are to really create engagement on the part of families. So with me today are Ashley Oakley from Native American Youth and Family Center in Portland, who's going to talk a little bit about what NAIA is excited about with this kind of opportunity, and David Bell from the Oregon College Savings Program. So they'll share a little bit more about what we're up to.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and members of the committee. Thank you very much for having us today. For the record, my name is Ashley Oakley, and I'm the Early Childhood Policy Advocate at the Native American Youth and Family Center. We are a culturally specific birth-to-elder wraparound services and early learning facility. We really value our children's opportunities, and we really try to do everything that we can to build a really strong foundation for our shared future. A well-designed college savings plan would really support us in being able to do that. We really need to build upon the existing college savings platform to better engage low-income communities, communities of color, and especially the Native community. Our families face a lot of barriers to engagement. For example, the initial deposit requirements, monthly minimums, fees. When I was evaluating our early learning programs in the last academic year, I asked a lot of families about their financial plans after high school or maybe as an alternative, and no one had heard of the 529 program. No one had accounts with them. So that was a hard realization to come to. I feel like students currently who could benefit most are not accessing it, and we need to create a better outreach program for partnering with community-based organizations. I like the universal aspect of it and then having targeted incentive programs. And the universal aspect of it would mean that we could better engage with schools and create more activities around it and engage parents around it a little bit better. We will hopefully ensure the program will be utilized by everyone who needs it the most. By better doing the outreach part of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Bell. I am the managing director of the Oregon 529 Savings Network, which manages the Oregon College Savings Plan and the Oregon ABLE Savings Plan, the new savings plan for people with disabilities. I don't always sound like this. Yesterday, I totally lost my voice, so I thought this was going to be real fun hearing on my behalf. I am here with the Treasury. So we are a division within the Treasury that are managing these savings plans. And we are very excited about working with neighborhood partnerships, with the wider committee, to make sure that we are getting these savings plans in the hands of all Oregonians. That's something we've been trying to do since our inception. Michael Parker, my boss, is here today. He established the Oregon College Savings Plan 18 years ago. And today, just to give you kind of a snapshot, the direct Oregon College Savings Plan, not the advisor sold, but the direct sold, has about 95,000 unique beneficiaries and $1.6 billion. So people are utilizing it. But are all people utilizing it? And that's the answer is no. There's individuals throughout the state that we've been trying to reach through our current outreach programs and many other things. We want people to have this notion of going to college as an opportunity for them. So it's been something that's been very important to us. It's also important to our board. Our board recently went through a strategic planning session where the idea of making sure that, yes, it only costs $25 to start an Oregon College Savings Plan, and that money goes directly into their plan. The fees are extremely low because we're lucky to be a state agency that now has assets, so we can really drive those down, much lower than any IRA or 401k. But that's not enough if we're not getting that information out into the hands of the individuals. And maybe at the right time, when they can be utilizing these at a much earlier age, to where those beneficiaries then have that time value of money working for them, then we're not doing enough. So all of that to say is we're going to continue to do all the great things that we can try to do to get this information out to all Oregonians. But I think one of the best things that we can do, and something that our treasurer is very excited about as well, is to work with partners like NIA, like Neighborhood Partners, and others to potentially establish this CSA program. We're very excited about the pilot. We think that we're hammering through the right aspects of what we can do with the resources that we have to make this very successful. I'll keep this real short, we have found within at least the College Savings Network that these types of incentives and seeds work. So one program that we had at a certain portion time of the year was called Baby Grad. Basically, it let families open up account for a baby that had been born in the last 12 months, and we would see $25 for that account, just $25. We're launching this program statewide and throughout the entire year, starting in 2018. But for the first 2 years of that, where we were only running at 3 months in each year, we seeded about $38,000 worth of these $25 accounts. Those accounts only had a closing rate of 1%, and that $38,000 was leveraged into $8.3 million worth of added contributions, upfront contributions, and added throughout time. That's one example. It's not going to be a perfect example moving forward, but we like that. We want to incentivize people and communities to come together and show our young, our next generation that college is available for them. Could be trade school, college, university, something that fits for their future. Thank you, and of course, I believe we're open for any questions that you might have.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I've been very quiet and
yes,
very
you
good
have.
Today.
I thought you might be interested in this particular topic.
Though. Yeah. Can you rewind a little bit for me? So the seed money, the $25, where did that come from? And is there more of that? And how, yeah.
Chair Lively, Representative Hack. That example that I gave for the Baby Grad program, the Oregon College Savings Plan funds itself off of the plan itself. The original general fund that was utilized for the plan was paid back within the first 2 years. So we're running off of the small fees off of the plan. And just to give you an idea, fees off the plan are between about 0.37 to 0.6%, or those are 37 to 60, 67 basis points. It's extremely low. But that allows us to have some money to do some marketing. We're pulling off some of our marketing dollars to run some of these incentive programs. Is there more of that? There's more of that to actually run Baby Grad throughout the entire year. Yes, we've actually established that, built a budget around it, and are now building out that program so we can launch it on January 1st. Did I answer your question?
Partly. Can I?
Sure.
Thank you. So how did you determine which children got the $25? Was there a criteria for that? And if so, who made that determination? Was that done within the department? How did you do that?
Chair Lively, Representative Hack, and I hope I didn't derail this by giving just the example of one of our programs, because this program was a little bit separate from what we're talking about here with children's savings accounts. I wanted to kind of give the example of how incentives work. To that point, this was a self-selected, meaning the family had to have opened up an Oregon College Savings Plan account during that time period. So they were self-selecting that they were going to. So they might have heard about it on the radio. They might have just happened to have opened it during those 3 months. And then we were seeding those accounts for any beneficiary that was under 12 months old. Moving forward with this program, meaning the baby grad program, not the CSA, the Children's Savings Accounts Program, for 2018, anybody who opens an account for somebody that a beneficiary that's under 12 months old, we will go ahead and just seed at $25 and communicate to them the importance of saving early, of talking to your children about the aspirations of education past high school.
He didn't answer all.
Can I? Sorry.
Oh.
So was it the department that made that decision then?
It was the Oregon College Savings Plan and the team that made the decision to run the baby grad program with our program managers. Yes, if I'm sorry, if I believe I'm understanding your question correctly.
Thank you.
I'm saying, can you go?
Thank you. You went through a lot of numbers really quickly. I want to make sure I got them. You said that generated $38,000 that leveraged a million something. Can you repeat what that was?
I sure can.
It leveraged it off of people going to college and getting scholarships? I didn't understand that whole piece.
And it probably didn't help that I sound like a frog right now either.
So I'm trying to understand it.
That sounds great. I can definitely do that. So Chair Lively, Representative Kenny Geyer, to answer that question, for the first 2 years that we piloted baby grad, it was only from January to March, so it was just the first three months out of the year. That total of 6 months over those 2 years, the Oregon College Savings Plan utilized some of our own marketing dollars to seed those $25 seeds. The total number of accounts we had to seed equaled $38,000 of our marketing dollars. So we put in $38,000 of our own, seeded to these accounts. Those accounts that we seeded either initially contributed or then went on to contribute up to $8.3 million worth of subsequent contributions. And the reason I brought that up was just to explain that sometimes all it takes is to just get it started. Some of these families just need to get it started, and then they will take over. Having extra incentives, very targeted, we're very excited about, because there's some families that may not be able to continue to keep that started, getting the whole community involved. And that's why we see some of the success that we've had in the past with these programs and want to see and be part of a wider children's savings account.
And so that $8.3 million was over how many years?
So that was over the first, by the time we ran those numbers, it was probably about 2.5 years.
Okay, and then one other question follow-up. You also said something about, in your current program, is it 95,000 accounts with 1.6
billion? So
wow.
The Oregon College Savings Plan is the direct. That would be where, for instance, I go online and sign up for my two daughters like I did. We also have we oversee an advisor sole plan through a group called MFS. So those numbers would even be larger if you're talking about that. But just the direct sold, yes, as of today, it's over 95,000 individual beneficiaries. So there's more accounts, because some people might, a grandpa might have an account for the same grandchild as a parent has. But 95,000 individual accounts, and all of those accounts are equaling up to over $1.6 billion. And that's their money that is going to be used for college. And something that's very exciting that we're seeing over the last few years is people are actually starting to use that money, right? In the initial stages, people were saving and their kids weren't to college. We're now seeing a lot of money being pulled out of the plan, which if we were a for-profit company, we'd be saying, whoa, this is scary. No, this is not scary. This is what we're here for. We want people utilizing this money for college and trade schools and secondary education.
So one more question.
Sure.
So last year, I remember out of this conversation that there was some consideration of folding the child savings account into the 509, starting yours, a lot of the features that you want in yours and yours, so that you have one vehicle as opposed to two. Are we not looking at that now, or is that still part of the pilot may evolve into that?
So Chair Lively, Representative Kenny Geyer, what we're looking at in the pilot is creating some sort of umbrella that would allow all of these options to move forward. So people might choose to save through the 529 platform. They might choose to save through a more traditional financial institution. We're still sort of working out what all the details and interlocking pieces of that are. Mm-hmm. We should, you know, maybe by late February, we might have some better idea. And if you had time in your schedule then for an informational hearing, we'd be happy to come back. But what we're recognizing is that people do want that choice of financial institution and financial product. So where the 529 is a great vehicle for some people and some families, it may not feel like what other people want. And so whether we're creating something that feels different or is in fact different, I think those are some of the things that we're piloting and testing.
Thank you, Chair Lively. You mentioned that Maine has been able to do $500 per childbirth, which would be about $6.3 million for their state. In Oregon, if we did the same, it would be about $23 million. How does Maine fund that?
Chair Lively and Representative Hayden, that's a privately funded program. It's a charitable foundation. I can't remember the gentleman's name. I think it's Charles Alvord, who set that up using his private fortune.
Set aside a large trust, and the interest just rolls on that. That's amazing.
It'd be amazing, yes.
That'd be nice.
Should we call Phil Knight?
Yes.
Only if they go to view of all.
True.
Other questions or comments?
Let me know what they're even missing.
Thank you, and again, it's encouraging. I know when we had these first conversations, and I know Representative Kenny Geyer and others raised the issue about how we make sure those people that have the least ability now to access the program can access it, because in many cases they're disadvantaged. And so I'm encouraged by the conversations here about working on that to make sure that everybody has equal access, and we don't overlook the fact that people at the lower end of the economic scale, this might be just out of their realm the way things are now. But I think it's encouraging what more we're learning, and we look forward to the conversations in the future how we might move forward with this.
Great. Thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the informational hearing on the child savings account.
I remember from last year.
So we're down to, we had one other informational meeting scheduled on developmental delayed eligibility for special education services. We're not ready to have that discussion at this meeting. They would like to do it in January. But there is so we have three committee bills. So there is, we need to have some discussion about whether we would use, we have one committee bill committed to the Office of Child Care, whether we would use one of those committee bills to go ahead and introduce the concept, and then, because the 21st is our deadline, to introduce the concept on this and then still have the hearing, have the first conversation in January and have the hearings in February during the short session. So, Kenny Geyer, would you like to...
On this next issue you're talking about?
Yeah, because we're not going to have a hearing, but I'm just suggesting that maybe we want to talk about what the issue is. Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that opportunity. And I think we were going to have a preview, discussion. A hearing, mm-hmm. but some of the people couldn't come, so that's why it's falling on me right now. So basically, out of a constituent coffee I had a kindergarten and a first grade teacher who said one of the things that's been really frustrating to them, and I raised this, I think, in our September hearing, mm-hmm. was that the IEP that they get in preschool or earlier intervention for developmental delays does not transfer into the K-12 system. There are other IEPs around communication and a variety of things, IEP being individual education program, that do go on, and I'm looking at Dana to make sure that I'm saying this right, that do go on to the K-12 system, but for some reason this particular one doesn't. And I believe that we're one of few, of just many states do have it go all the way through. And so Dana was in that last hearing from Children's Institute and came up and said, actually, this is something we've been very concerned about for a while. We'd love to work with you on that. So we did have just a work group meeting by phone just this past week that Children's Institute and a number of different early intervention and Disability Council, a variety of people, and Chair Lively, was anyone else from this committee on it? I don't think so. Participated, and there are about 200 or 300 kids that fall into this category. But what ends up happening is they get these services, then they go to kindergarten, the IEP is dropped, and then it takes teachers, you know, through kindergarten to first grade to kind of say, hey, wait a minute, this child is developmentally delayed, and it's often not till second or third grade that they get it. So we lose this. So my understanding is also that in the past, schools have had some concern about if you have this IEP, it means that you're mandated to have special services, and they're worried about the finances. But what I would say to that is, boy, we're doing a lot more catch-up and having to put more money. Schools are having to put more money when you get to third grade and you're not at reading level. And our whole point, I believe, of our committee is how do you do this transition between early childhood and the K through 12. So I am very enthusiastic. I think everyone on the phone was very enthusiastic and a lot of unanimity in feeling about going forward with the concept of at least making sure that this IEP, just like all the other IEPs, gets carried through to the K through 12. I believe there's another issue that might be a 2019 issue about lowering the eligibility. Right now you have to have two, but you could go down to one. I'm sorry, that's a little complicated. You'd want to bring her up. But that would include more children. It would open it up more if we went that direction. That might be a bigger discussion, but I think at the very least, the kids that are eligible now and are getting it should be able to get it in the K through 12 system. I think it's a fabulous committee bill. It's right up our alley, and it's something that people have been working on for a while.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you might want to call Dana up, actually, to answer these questions.
Let's have him ask a question and we'll see.
So my question is, for children that are developmentally disabled often have, they're delayed, right?
Right.
And so my understanding through prior committee hearings is that, you know, basically the feds pay for part of it, state pays for part of it, and it's 0 through 23, I think, 22, 23. But then the state takes and chops that up into about three different sections. In the preschool, they cut off at 5, but the kids that are receiving these IEPs often legitimately should be in preschool till 6 or 7, but they get disenfranchised because their chronological age becomes 5. Mm-hmm. Their intellectual age might be 2 years delayed. So in this mix, can we fix that? My understanding is it's a state decision, a state policy for these children that are developmentally delayed that need it. Can we fix that age gap? I want to do that.
So we're going to open information and discussion. And Dana, you come up. That's a very good question. I don't think that's where we started with this, but that's not to suggest that
and you
we
have
introduced
brought this up before.
I have.
Yes.
Right.
It's a concern of mine.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Dana Hepper. I'm the Director of Policy and Program at the Children's Institute, and I would start with a disclosure that we're not a special education advocacy organization. At our core, we work closely with FACT Oregon, Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, the Northwest Down Syndrome, I think they just changed the name, Northwest Disability Association. So all of those organizations are going to have more nitty-gritty detail and strong opinions on special education policy stronger than us. We just helped to do some convening of those groups around this developmental delay issue that's a misalignment between early childhood and K-12. I'm not familiar with the specific question that you're asking around whether other states are allowing kids to stay in preschool beyond the kindergarten entry age, the allowable age for kindergarten entry. And so that's something I would be interested in doing a little more digging and research on. I guess what I would say is for kids who have a developmental delay eligibility in preschool and then do no longer have that eligibility in kindergarten, they're no longer receiving those support services to help them thrive in the kindergarten classroom. So it's like a double whammy. Maybe they're not old enough, and also they're not getting supports that they would have otherwise have been getting. So it doesn't solve the entirety of the issue that you're raising, but it's halfway there. At least they're getting supports to be successful as possible if they could maintain this eligibility.
So I don't think it's clear, Representative Hayden, given what is the legislation that was introduced and talked about before, whether that fits perfectly in it, but I think it's a very valid question. Mm-hmm. As you know, the problem here is a timing problem, with, since we aren't going to get a chance to have any more conversations about this until after we've had to submit a legislative concept. That's not to suggest, though, that somehow as in January when we have this conversation, there isn't something more we can do there, but I just don't any way to know that at this point, because that's not in the original concept.
So, Chair Lally, do we have a, if this were the second one, do we have a third committee bill still available?
Yes, we do have.
Because I would suggest that maybe we develop a concept and at least hear that and hear.
Well, the concept is pretty simple. If your child's developmentally delayed and they might want to stay in early learning past five. Currently they get cut off.
Right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Once they get the chronological age of five, they get
cut off. It's my understanding that so, if you turn five by September 1st, you can't be served in early childhood special ed anymore. You need to be served in K-12 special ed.
Those parents face the choice of pushing their child into kindergarten, and that's a different misconnect, but they're pushing them earlier than the child really, in my opinion, should be. So we need somehow to allow that cushion time for them to stay with services in early learning. And people argue that, well, on the 23, you know, by the time they turn 23, you know, they won't have those last 2 years. Well, I think it were much more beneficial on the early years than 21 and 22.
Agreed.
Representative Hack, I think you had
a... I do. Thank you, Chair. And I don't know if you can answer this or not, but what is... So when they do the IEP, is there a disconnect? Because I know what happens when they get to the school, the IEP process, if and when that starts, takes a certain amount of time and all the folks have to be involved. So when the IEP process starts at the early learning stage, is the school involved at that point? Is there a collaboration that begins to happen at the early learning phase? Does that happen? If it does, what does that look like? If it doesn't, why isn't it happening? Because why are we seeing this big disconnect that we do here so many times, that it's, which is why we're doing this?
Yeah.
What are we doing to bridge that gap?
So, Chair Lively, Representative Hack, there are 14 eligibility categories in special education in Oregon in early childhood special ed. So those include, you know, deafness, blindness, autism, communication, intellectual disability, et cetera. There's a list. And there are defined criteria and administrative rule for all 14 categories. When you move to K-12, there are 13 categories. So all of the ones in early childhood special ed except for developmental delay, which is a more nebulous category. So it's one where you may have a child who doesn't have a specific diagnosis, like Down syndrome or blindness or whatever, but they're adequately delayed that it's clear that they need support services in order to meet their full potential. And so this is just...
It's emotional challenges, right?
It may be social-emotional challenges, communication. Basically, the criteria is you have to be two standard deviations behind typically developing peers in one category or 1.5 standard deviations behind your peers in two or more categories. Then you would be eligible under this category of eligibility to receive services. The feds made this eligibility category available, I think it was in the 90s, and allowed states to decide what age range, what the definition of eligibility would be. And Oregon adopted it for early childhood special ed, but just did not adopt it up to age 9. We just adopted it up to kindergarten entry. So that's where you have a gap in services for kids. What happens with all children who have an individualized family service plan, which is like the early childhood version of the IEP, is there's a transition meeting in the spring before kindergarten entry, where the child's team should come together, and that team could include a range of people, but it would include your early childhood special ed provider. It would include your K-12 school. and it would include your parents at a minimum, and may include other specialists or experts. And that meeting is to plan for IEP services to be delivered in K-12. In many cases, you know, let's say you have a child who is hearing impaired, that hearing impairment eligibility will continue on in K-12, and you don't need to do a reassessment to determine, is the child still hearing impaired? Are they still eligible for services? There's just a discussion of what the services will be. In the case of developmental delay, if that is your eligibility, the child must go through reassessment to see if they're eligible under one of the 13 allowable categories in K-12. So that could mean an IQ test, a speech and language test. It would mean a number of assessments decided by the team to determine their eligibility. And what we've heard, what the Department of Ed heard from many families when they went around the state and had listening sessions with parents to understand their perspective, was that many families felt like this was pretty early to do all of those assessments, that an IQ test on a five-year-old, especially a five-year-old with significant delays, is going to give you less accurate, useful information than an IQ test on an eight-year-old, and that potentially delaying some of those reassessments until down the road and allowing continuation of kids who aren't fitting into one of our boxes exactly, allowing continuation of services would be a better path forward for kids in this developmental delay category.
Can I have a sure. Thank you, Chair. So wouldn't it be fair to say then that even the broader issue here is maybe that the instead of cutting off the 14 pieces, the 14 dots, the 14 criteria at five, that you look at saying those 14 need to be carried over to seven or nine? So because if that's really the case, even doing what we're doing is not going to fix the problem. If that criteria isn't even one of the criteria that they're looking at anyway, This isn't going to fix it.
So, Chair Lively and Vice Chair Hack, the proposal on the table is to extend that eligibility category up through age 9, which is what the federal law allows.
And that would be all 14.
Yeah, that would take, the 13 are the same.
Okay.
This 14 is the only one that doesn't carry forward. So this proposal, the concept put forward by the department leading up to the 2017 session that didn't get picked up.
All those people would be at the table at the time of entry into kindergarten if we didn't do it. I mean, if we can fix what you're saying, might not be an issue.
Right.
Even, but if it was, they would all be at the table to say, okay, we're still not there yet, so this criteria still fits, and we're going to let them. Okay, that makes sense.
You've got it.
Got it. Okay.
So, and I just say, Chair Lively, it's certainly possible to include your Hayden's concept into this one because they're related. Mm-hmm. Your concept is about all 14 categories as opposed to this one. I don't know how in general the disability community feels, so I always worry about throwing something in after there's been a lot of discussion about this one and then throwing it in. So I worry about disability community saying, we're against this bill, you know, when there's and there's another vehicle, which is why, you know, I'd feel more comfortable if we have another vehicle exploring both of these concepts, not trying to put them into one. If we only had one vehicle,
that's fair.
I would be very open to it. So that would be my proposal.
One clarification. You're saying with this proposal, at age 9, it just dropped to 13 instead of 14.
No. Oh, with this proposal?
No? Yes.
Chair Lively, Representative
13,
Hayden.
Right?
No. Yeah, there is still a transition that would need to happen, like at the end of third grade.
Mm-hmm. All of the categories.
Yes. Yeah. Well, if a child was eligible under developmental delay, now in kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, they would still need to see if they were still eligible under another category by fourth grade. So there still is that cutoff point, but it comes later in a child's development when the likelihood of the assessments being giving you accurate information is improved.
That makes sense.
I guess the other thing I'd just quickly add is that we'd be happy to be a conduit to also take this concept back. We have a little team of folks who have been meeting on a regular basis that include the organizations I mentioned and also the Oregon Association of ESDs. So we'd be also
to take
your question back to them.
So
Let me follow up on that. Thank you.
Did I say you could?
May I?
Yes.
Okay.
Good reminder. What do you
think? IEPs, I always get nervous when we talk about chronological age.
Yeah.
So what I hear you saying is age 9. But why isn't that third grade? Why? Because you might have a 10-year-old in third grade.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, why are we talking about chronological age when you're talking about developmentally disabled,
yes,
which is a lower age than their peer group? Why aren't we talking about the level that they have achieved?
Yeah, Chair Lively and Representative Hayden, I think that's a great question. Federal law allows developmental delays and eligibility through age 9, or up to age 9.
Well, we need to change that.
Good luck on that. But. So, thank you, Dana. I mean, and I appreciate your coming up because we hadn't really had planned, but I appreciate your questions in order to talk about this particular concept. We do have another, at least one other potential for a committee bill that we need to talk about before we commit to that. But I just, on this particular one, we've had the conversations. They will be ready in January to come answer more of these and talk about specifically and have people both from the K through 12 system and the early learning system to talk about what that transition is. And I share your why age 9. Well, it's what we're stuck with right now, but at least this will be a step in the right direction. So my recommendation would be at least this be one of the, we have three committee bills, this would be the second one of our committee bills. If that's
a great bill.
Yeah, okay. I'm supportive.
Okay. Yeah. I thought you probably.
Even though it doesn't get us all the way.
No.
Yeah.
It's
a small step.
It's a start.
It's a good goal.
So it's not a suggestion. Staff here, she had pointed out the whole rule around school attendance. And you've brought this up before, Representative Hayden, about school attendance. And that kind of goes back to that age thing again.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be another mechanism, and I can talk to Representative Doherty about that since she's on that, because there may be another way to also get at what you're trying to get at that's separate from this particular effort. So we can have some conversations, again, with the timing being so tight, we'll just have to see where it goes.
Okay.
So the other concept has to do with a request or a bill we had last time. We had this bill on an equity fund, the $5 million that came from the Latino network. And we introduced the bill last session, but obviously we didn't get a chance to move very far with that specific bill. It brings with it a lot of very important implications and opportunities. And so we have a conversation about introducing the bill again. So let me just talk a little bit about what the implications of that are. We don't know currently what we may be facing in our next session regarding the budget. There's some conversations about any requests for new programs, regardless of all the other things going on, that we wouldn't take those on, because all that does, if we decide to, and how would you decide which ones, but if we decide on a new program, then that agree to fund it in the amount of time we have left, then that adds to the bigger problem we have in 2019 about the roll-up costs. But there's also the issue then if we don't continue having the conversations about it, do we then have to start over in 2019? And this is a particular one since we've already heard it, started the conversations and people were supportive with the concepts here. Do we not, if we don't keep the bill kind of around, will it kind of get lost in the shuffle? So come 2019, we have to really start over. So it kind of goes back to the approach. I've talked to others that have asked about other types of things. And so part of it always is, so how is the best mechanism to keep the conversation going? So we have the opportunity now, recognizing that the likelihood is almost probably zero 2018 session, just given the budget issues and things we have. So is that a good use of a committee bill, given that we had the three committee bills, or is there some other topic Representative Hayden raised to that's of higher importance at this time that we would use the bill for to have the ability to have the conversation during the short session?
Well, you're the man in the big chair.
Well, I'm asking your opinion.
I have an opinion on
Kitty Geyer.
Well, I love that bill. And so I didn't realize that was a possibility for a committee bill. So I think if we can have more things on the table, then I would embrace you including that concept in the previous bill that we were talking about, as long as you know that I hope that if there's not a huge body of support around it, that it wouldn't sink that one, the one that's kind of been on track and, been around for a while and has had some work put into it. I would embrace you using this opportunity to explore it, and I would heartily support that bill as a third committee bill.
And I would just encourage you again, when we have the conversation in January about this other bill, is we'll have some more conversations at that point about your concept and that, because it doesn't mean there isn't a way yet to to at least have some kind of address it. But in the meantime, I will talk to Representative Daugherty, too, about the whole thing about the age, the requirement for entering school. So I'll see what we can do. Any other comments about the third bill being the equity bill?
I have one comment. I don't have a lot to say because I'm still trying to understand the process.
We all are, too.
So,
don't feel alone on that.
So I would say on both bills, I think anything we can do to make sure that kids have a seamless transition throughout different systems that we have in the state, and that we're not re-spending money, and that kids aren't losing the services that they need to thrive. I think that's an important investment. And then on the equity fund, I think the ROI on the investment that we make, especially in communities of color, will translate to higher graduation rate and higher worker productivity numbers, is what we need for our Oregon economy. So I would support both concepts, especially from the standpoint of just being fiscally responsible and making sure kids get what they need. So.
Okay. Representative Hack?
Thank you. So on the third concept, and I haven't seen anything that you've got put together on that yet, but I'm supportive. I just want to make sure that we have measurable outcomes, that the funding that goes for these projects, I know that it'll be up to the Early Learning Division to decide these grants, but I would like to see some parameters put around that, that any and all funding given, that they come back and they report on their progress, much like what we did with House Bill 2013, I think that was, or the African American funding that we did,
2016, I think.
It was a similar amount of money, and we did some really great work with that, but we had a lot of parameters around that, and it worked. So I would like to see us do something similar to that so that we have just the reassurance that what we're investing in and giving the latitude to the Early Learning Division to make those decisions, that we also have the parameters around that, and that they're coming back and letting us know what they're doing with those dollars.
That's the transparency and the accountability. I mean, you're absolutely right.
And we gave half of those dollars, and then they came back and they reported, and we saw the work that was being done, and then we said, okay, we'll go ahead and give the other half of that, and they've done some remarkable work. So I would just like to see y'all think about that when you put that together.
So the intent would be to introduce the bill we introduced last time, but that conversation, that would be part of the reason to do it now and not wait and start over again, is to have those conversations to get more of the parameters around what we think would be ultimately required to get it approved and start doing it. And those are some of the questions we'd want to ask and decide to do that. But that's what, hopefully we get that done in the short session, those conversations. If not, continue some a work group or something after that, just to make sure that all of that's kind of together when we come back, whoever comes back in 2019. I said whoever comes back in 2019.
That was a telling, whoever comes back.
Up to the people.
Yep.
To the people. That's right. I've got to be careful. Any assumptions here? Okay. So at this point, then I would say that's what we'll do with the bill. And then I will talk to Representative Daugherty right away about the other to see if there's something they can work on there, too. So.
Yeah, I think she kind of understands my passion for it. And if we could do something, that'd be great.
Sure. Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else? Looks like that's it. Huh? Okay.
So.
Thank you all for attending. Look forward to seeing you, most of you, in January. You're adjourned. I didn't say who.